What's called food security bears on the availability, accessibility, and affordability of nutritious food. How these factors are related in a given community answers a fundamental question about the level of health and well-being. The question has been applied to big government programs and world summits, but it's also become one of the grassroots issues of our time. We'll try to get a picture of food security as it applies to local communities next on MediaMate. Welcome to WNMU's MediaMeet. I'm Bill Hart. Our guests are Market Area Salvation Army Captain Doug Winters, retired Northern Michigan University Nutrition Professor Moe Moafi, and NMU Food Recovery Network President Joe Dodd. Welcome. First, being so fundamental, you know, food security is actually an ancient topic, going back at least to the Egyptians.
Oh, yes.
But it's been a global issue since just after World War II. Food is a category in the 1948 UN Declaration of Human Rights. Food supply and sustainability were the big themes for the 1974 World Food Conference. The 1996 World Food Summit added concerns over access. And science and sociology were added to these factors in a peer-reviewed journal on food security that premiered in 2009. So there are a lot of facets to the problem. Dr. Moafi, you're a professor who took an active interest in dietetics. You taught courses in nutrition and cultural food patterns. You were faculty advisor for the student group Feed the People in the late 70s and served 3 years on the National Council for World Food Day. How did all that come about for you?
Interesting, actually, for an like anything else big does, unannounced.
Okay.
they just happen. But it really is a keen interest of mine. And that example you mentioned, how ancient it was, maybe we actually all know the story of the Pharaoh's nightmare and then Joseph interpreting that to him, that there will be 7 years of prosperity and then 7 years of famine.
Right.
So, of course, the idea of storing food. Mm-hmm. That principle has not changed.
Okay.
And in all of the conferences that you mentioned, that they even legislated things about food, it is basically the same concept, the availability.
Okay.
That is key. Sometimes, of course, the production is not enough. As we were talking before, that, you know, the Malthusian catastrophe never happened. But it is something to really be careful not to ignore. There is an increase in world population, and it is related in many places to the adequacy of the food available. And that's why the United Nations really had, on several occasions, stressed that.
Stressed the importance of food security.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, we live in a really beautiful community. I've lived here for 50 years, but I am not really sure that Marquette is the example of the entire UP. We are more fortunate here than the rest of the UP, and particularly in that availability of, according to the United Nations, everyone. Mm-hmm. There is no exception.
Okay. This is a good, this brings us to a question for Doug. Salvation Army workers and volunteers have to determine what the needs are and what works best as they confront these problems directly in the community. How do things look on the level of food security here as you see them? We appear to have a very responsive community, as Moe alluded to. What's the level of need and how well is it being met as you see it?
Yeah, I've lived here for 2.5 years now, and the level of support in the community is just incredible. The generosity of folks to watch out for their neighbors, to take care of friends, it's amazing. It's very striking to see that. How are we doing? I think we're staying even. We're not falling behind where we are. But again, it goes back to the generosity of the folks. We've seen year over year from 2017 to 2018, mm-hmm. a 20% increase in the number of people coming through our food pantries. We've seen a 40% increase in the number of food baskets we're delivering. So not only are people coming to see us more often, they're actually coming back for food yeah. on a more regular basis. So the need is there.
Okay, that brings us to a complex point. The U.S. Census figures, most recent ones, 2017 and 18, indicate that things have improved in the past year or so related to food security across the country. But the states are all different, and so might be communities within any particular state. How would you compare the challenges this year versus, you said the last 2 years you've got year over year. Mm-hmm. What about, are these mostly focused in the winter time?
It's a year-round situation.
Okay.
Certainly during the summer, some of the other factors, housing is a little bit easier, staying warm is easier during the summer, but sure. the food security issue is a year-round thing, and so the programs of food pantry or feeding programs that we have available, it's a year-round endeavor.
Okay. Waste and efficiency are big factors in providing adequate food. The Food Recovery Network on the NMU campus cites data showing 133 billion pounds of food is lost each year in the U.S. That's 31% of total production. Joe, you're an NMU student and president of the Food Recovery Network chapter on campus, working to curb waste and divert food to people who need it. How did it come about? How did your interest in it come about? And how does it operate?
Well, Food Recovery Network originally started in Maryland. A girl named Cam Pascal, she was working at the dining hall on campus, as well as a local homeless shelter. And she had a troubling time dealing with the amount of food that was being disposed of while she was also working another job where these people couldn't meet their needs. And so she basically started this small group to save these perishable food items at the end of the night from the dining halls and take them to a place in need. Wow. Within the first year, this is back in 2011 when food mm-hmm. insecurity kind of became to be more apparent, the issue of it. And when that first year, it went from 22 chapters to 98 chapters. And today, Food Recovery Network has over 230 chapters in 46 states in the United in the U.S. And so that proves that this concept is scalable. As far as Food Recovery Network here up in Marquette, mm-hmm. this is the first one in the UP. We work closely with dining services on campus to coordinate with our volunteers as well, setting aside food and pick up and drop off right. as well. But food is a very important issue for our university too.
And I think one of the things you're confronting here in this group is that food standards are tough. I mean, you can't leave cheese out more than X number of hours or something and serve mm-hmm. it. You know, that's why a lot of the stuff goes into the dumpster. Mm-hmm. So how do you interdict this before things are not, considered to be a public health problem?
It's about essentially incorporating into the training of employees at local dining halls and making that part of the service instead of, basically Food Recovery Network is just this group of really innovative students that are, they're challenging the status quo and, they're looking to mix things up and they don't like it the way that it is. And so these students are coming together to work with the dining halls to make recovery the norm instead of waste, and that I believe that's putting higher education on the right track, because as a university we should not only we should take it from like a business aspect and be both environmentally sustainable and also practice good business practices.
Waste is still money.
Mm-hmm, certainly is.
So how much have you distributed now since the organization was put together?
Well, for our organization, it has accounted up to roughly around 1,600 pounds total. We started at the beginning of last semester in January, and so it's still growing. It's we're picking up every month, every week. It's a big thing, but on the national scale, it's huge. It's really encouraging every week because Food Recovery Network posts these updates telling us how much, it's like Metrics Monday, and how much food is being recovered on a whole national level. And so we're looking at like averages of like 13,000 to 15,000 pounds of food a week from all these students. And you know, it's just impressive numbers, but all in all, since 2011, Food Recovery National has recovered over 3 million pounds of food. And that is approximately like 2.8 million meals for people who need those calories.
Incredible. The network adds that level of scrutiny related to food waste, which accounts to 21% of the material of the U.S. waste stream, and represents $166 billion. Speaking of money, in labor, energy, and water losses. So, you know, it's good work you're doing there. Much of the food is obviously perishable, and scaled up food recovery and diversion are becoming part of the food strategy now. Mm-hmm. Food security strategy. Donated food from various quarters is more common. Doug, has this been taken up among your peers to a significant degree, donated food and repurposed food?
We are seeing that. Perishable is good. Let's put that out there. Perishable food is more nutritious than processed mm-hmm. food, canned food. So perishable is good. It's a distribution and getting it out there before it perishes. Some of the local efforts, we see that some of the food distributors, Reinhardt Foods, Pepsi Foods, are major contributors to the Salvation Army of product that is just about ready to be done, wow. and they can get that into our hands.
Excellent.
The grocery stores with bread products, Econo, Super One, even Meijer, now that they're in town, massive amounts of product they're giving to us on a daily basis. We've got the infrastructure to be able to get that out to the people that need that.
Good.
It's a grassroots effort. On a little bit more regional scale, there's organizations like Feeding America that are buying food or getting donated food from large warehouses, and they can get the food cheap. They have a network to be able to get that out to us quickly as well, food that's near perishable, yeah. and then we can get that out to the people that need okay. it. So we're seeing that on multiple levels, both local and regional.
Moe, you belong to a couple of food efforts in town. You participate in them. I know Room at the Inn is one, and there's another
community
with St. Paul's or something. What are you seeing in terms of the scaled-up food recovery and distribution thing?
Well, this is one of the features that I really adore about Marquette. It's not just St. Paul. There are many, many churches.
Sure,
there
I
is
know.
Also
the
warming house.
Room at the
yeah.
mm-hmm.
And of course, the need in the winter really is magnified. And okay. it's very easy to understand yeah. why. Can we do more? Of course. Would more be welcomed? Of course.
Yeah.
But when it comes to hinging anything on volunteering only, you have to accept the fact that your probably number of volunteers are not going to be steady, mm-hmm. and you have to kind of cope how to deal with that.
Okay.
The amount is really not inadequate, in my view. Mm-hmm. The distribution is just hovers on lousy. Mm-hmm. So that the food is there, and like you were saying, honestly, you have no idea how much my heart was singing, listening to you, because you really are the future, and I just cannot imagine a better way yeah. to grow up this way.
Unfortunately, mentioning the like policies and practices that lead to that waste, there's a lot of different issues there, going from the big scale to like the farmer, basically. Of course, there's like agricultural like subsidies that they're implemented, but a lot of farmers they want to donate, but that it's just they lack an economic incentive. It's really expensive to donate this food. You have to you basically have to box it up, store it, coordinate deliveries. Yeah. It's a lot of overhead.
You're saying right now things are set up in such a way that it's not really in their interest to go
whole hog. Not at all.
To speak. Okay.
Unfortunately, and basically, you can't fault businesses for caring about their bottom line. They are not charities.
Reality.
Yeah, unfortunately, but they should be incentivized. Basically, and so that kind of. That's
something that's been brought up. The incentivization thing has been brought up in numerous reports.
Mm-hmm.
And even the most current I saw on food security for Michigan alone in 2018. So it's a point I think that people are sharing right now. They're going to start passing around. The practice is not without critics. A health department in Kansas City this year raided some ad hoc and volunteer events feeding homeless people, and they said they were responding to concerns over foodborne illnesses, threats to safety, and negative effects on quiet residential neighborhoods. Apparently, a lot of homeless people tend to congregate in neighborhoods where they weren't welcome. So the citizen group said they were using public and donated spaces and responded that the dangers, if any, were no greater than those at a church social or a picnic. I mean, if you set one of these things up on a Sunday, it's pretty much the same kind of thing. I'd like to hear your views on that very grassroots approach to food security. Public health folks really aren't the enemy, but you're pretty secure in the fact that we're meeting the public health standards at least enough to make sure that people are not getting sick from anything we're serving them, right?
Absolutely. In our feeding programs, we have our staff is served safe, trained, qualified. The health inspector is in every year,
okay.
The same as a restaurant. So those aren't the issue. But this whole idea of a grassroots effort to help neighbors, that's how you get people involved.
Yes.
When people can put a face behind the person that they're, or face in front of the person that they're helping, that's where they'll be, that's the incentive you're talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
That's where they see that that their efforts are making a difference.
Yeah.
And so we cannot lose that whole concept of grassroots effort to help our neighbors, to help the people in front of us.
Okay. It happens at the market. Go ahead.
A very important point you really raised,
sure.
And that is the health standards. And even though, this is part of my professional career and all of that, again, in my view, we sometimes really exaggerate the damage that may happen if you have an orange juice that has an expired date of yesterday. I mean, some people really take that like biblical teaching. And I think part of the people that with you and with you are intelligent enough to realize that this is really not a bad piece of cheese just because it's expired.
It's X hours
old. We can control that. We can
say it's not even expired. I mean, we're talking about hours difference.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
The data on food sometimes is not a food safety date. It could be food quality. Maybe the flavor has started to diminish.
Exactly.
That's the date that the manufacturers are using that they don't want to sell after that date.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
The federal government does not require any food to carry an expiration date. It is simply decided by the manufacturer. There's a lack of standardized date labeling is the part of the issue there. And it kind of comes down to one of the most useful tools is your nose when it comes to deciding if something is fresh. But a
your
lot of
nose
yeah,
yourself.
But unfortunately, with those dates being decided from the manufacturer, what's to stop them from shortening that and making it the tightest time frame possible? So your consumer purchases another item, and so unfortunately, profit is kept in mind there, but. That's just one of the issues. Standardized date labeling is it's a very, very important topic to cover and implement.
I need to take a moment here to remind our viewers and especially our radio listeners that we're talking about food security with Market Area Salvation Army Captain Doug Winters, retired Northern Michigan University Nutrition Professor Moe Mwafi, and NMU Food Recovery Network President Joe Dodd. It happens that the Marquette County Health Department, among others, is responsible for regulating retail food establishments. They don't directly deal with food security. They don't deal with food banks, state and federal assistance programs, or food recovery. But public health statistics are relevant, and one of them that came from the latest report, a 2018 report from all six UP public health departments, has some helpful information. Mainly, it shows that 17% of UP households live below the poverty line. So that brings up health disparities by income, which is commonly acknowledged, but it makes these folks twice as likely to be in poor health, more than twice as likely to be in poor health, be uninsured, and face prohibitive health costs. So any observations on food security for this group, Moy?
My core belief is always education, and that really is, in fact, one of my student organizations.
Okay.
The Student Dietetic Organization used to do that. They would go to grocery store and not force themselves or anything. Mm-hmm. But the public needs to be educated, especially if your means are limited.
Yeah.
What to spend it on. You know, I'm not anti-potato chips, but if that is what you really, your focus,
sorry,
and it's an unhealthy, yeah, lifestyle, mm-hmm, that is going to increase your health care requirement, and then you will end up in this impossible dilemma of, should I buy my insulin or should I eat?
I see.
And
okay,
that, yeah, that happens locally too, actually.
Mm-hmm. Very good point. Doug, these things related to income or income status are addressed in some Salvation Army programs. You guys do a lot for people. Do cases generally cluster together? Now, food, transportation, housing, all those things. How would you estimate the effect of those programs on food security?
Yeah, they absolutely cluster together. A family that's struggling with medical insurance or getting to the doctor are making decisions of whether they should buy food or medicine.
Mm-hmm.
They enter into a downward spiral almost of paying for the most urgent thing right now, and there's really not a long-term sustainable solution in their family of where am I going with food security, because they're bouncing from emergency to emergency, and they just gets into a cycle that they struggle with.
Yeah. Here's a group that's been underestimated in this regard. Today's college students, you know, in the past, people who went to college were considered a privileged class, and with good reason. But today's college students can be viewed as being among low-income people threatened by food insecurity. In a 2016 national survey by the College and University Food Bank Alliance, almost half of the respondents reported food insecurity. You know, college is too expensive, or so expensive now, as to crowd out a lot of other spending, even for students who are working part-time. Joe, what do you see on campus?
I certainly agree that it's challenging to manage a budget. A lot of students are coming to school for the first time. They're on their own, and they're trying to figure out how to, you know, allocate their funds to, you know, which thing that brings them, like, you know, leisure, enjoyment, food, and there's a lot of different things you can be spending your money on as a student, but unfortunately, once you get into the dorms, it's kind of like an all you can eat buffet, and there is no there is no incentive to not dispose of like excess food.
Yeah.
But
try and control the problem by portion control or something.
Yeah,
like
yeah
that.
There are a lot of strategies that actually Food Recovery Network, we work with NMU Dining to kind of like give our suggestions. Like, for example, we do like a food waste audit and kind of understand what's going back there. Like, we, you know, that's kind of like my capstone project, is I decided to get my hands dirty and I went to NMU Dining and asked them, I'm like, can I use this as, you know, research? And, you know, it really, it makes our campus like a living laboratory, and I saw the opportunity, and it was great. But coming back to students dining, once they leave the dorms, unfortunately, something happens is you have to realize, they begin to realize that food is probably one of the largest expenses in your,
yeah,
budget there. And
especially now.
Yeah, and, mm-hmm, and if you can't quickly learn how to take that food and prepared, you know, consistently, and you know, because a lot of, you know, nowadays it's like, you know, it's over 70% of our meals are prepared by somebody else, and so feeding yourself as a student can be a challenge, and it doesn't help when students are, you know, going to these jobs. It kind of ties back into policy, you know, food policy is, you know, students are going to jobs, but at the end of the night, it's like when they're working on an empty stomach, you know, they have all this excess food that they have to throw away at the end of the night. It's just like you feel ashamed to do such a thing, and it's really it's kind of tough. But
some of us who grew up with parents who went through the Depression saw that you know, saw how people react to wasted food.
Yes. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that stat of 70% of the food is prepared by somebody else. Mm-hmm. That itself contributes to waste, because you always over-prepare if you don't know who you're serving or how many people you're serving, and so that itself is part of the problem is the prepared food consumption in the U.S. today.
It comes down to convenience. Right?
Yes, convenience.
Yeah, we're always on the go.
Mo, you want to compare notes? You were twice named both a distinguished faculty member and superior teacher at NMU. What did you hear from students related to food security?
Very honestly, the students that worked with me at an organization, whether it is the Student Dietetic Organization, whether it is Feed the People or the Sustainability, and I do not know what makes somebody is more keen on finding a purpose.
Yeah.
And these kids were that.
Yeah, they found
that was a purpose for them. And it really was. It was an absolute pleasure to work with them. But one of the things that made it very easy to work with them also is that they really did believe that we have to educate the public, not to make the mistakes that some people actually would look at it and say, you're making so many mistakes, you don't even deserve to be helped. Oh, you are eating potato chips and complaining that you cannot buy your insulin.
Right.
So that is a very important role in the community, and Northern can really help you with that.
Okay. I'm going to ask one question, put you on the spot here. We got 30 seconds, Doug. What do you think the community priority should be in building food security?
I think there is excellent coordination among a lot of the agencies, and even more of that. Mm-hmm. We've talked about distribution here. We've talked about excess foods, the canathons that we have, the postal can drive. All of those things are great. Coordinating that, getting the food to the people that need it the most, is one of the big things that that we can take a step forward on. We live in an incredible community, very generous community, and being able to leverage that to so that everyone is taken care of is got to be a priority.
Okay, I'm afraid we have to leave it there. We've been talking about food security with Marquette Area Salvation Army Captain Doug Winters, retired Northern Michigan University Nutrition Professor Moe Moafi, and NMU Food Recovery Network President Joe Dodd. Thank you all for being here.
Thanks.
I'm Bill Hart. Thanks for joining us on Media Meet.
The preceding program was produced in studios located in the Edgar L. Hardin Learning Resources Center by WNMU-TV, Northern Michigan University Public Television. We'll be right back.